Well, you were just listening to Moondog's theme as taken from the 1969 album on Columbia titled simply Moondog. Well, that LP was my personal introduction to this amazing, eclectic personality who was born on May 26, 1916 and passed away in 1999. Today we celebrate the 100th birthday of Lewis Hardin, otherwise known as Moondog, and today's program is titled simply Howling at the Moondog in observance of his 100th birthday. Lewis Thomas Hardin was an American composer and known as Moondog. He was a composer, musician, poet, and inventor of several musical instruments. Moondog was blind from the age of 16. In New York from the late 1940s until he left in 1972, he could often be found on 6th Avenue between 52nd and 55th Street wearing a cloak and Viking-style helmet, sometimes busking or selling music, but often just standing silent and still. He was widely recognized as the Viking of 6th Avenue by thousands of passersby and residents who weren't aware of his musical career. I know when I was a child, I knew of Moondog and was always looking for him whenever I was in New York, but sadly, I never was able to locate him. So that was something which I do remember after many, many years. I was searching but could never find him. Today, I am honored to be joined by an expert on Moondog, Gavin Black, who has recorded his music and knew him for the last 22 years of his life. Gavin, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
We're going Delighted to have a to be really here. Fun
oh,
couple
yes,
of hours
absolutely.
Here. Very briefly, Gavin Black was born and raised in New Haven, Connecticut, a resident of Central New Jersey since 1983. He has been the director of the Princeton Early Keyboard Center since 2001, where he teaches harpsichord, clavichord, continual playing, organ, and anything and everything related to Baroque keyboard instruments and repertoire. He has performed and recorded on Baroque keyboard instruments for the last 30 years, performing the complete organ music of Bach, other 17th and 18th century organ repertoire, and harpsichord music from the early Renaissance on, with an emphasis on Sphaling and Frescobaldi. He is a 1979 graduate of Princeton University, where he majored in history, specializing in the medieval period. He also has a Master of Music degree in organ performance from Westminster Choir College, where he studied with Professor Eugene Roan. He has also performed and recorded harpsichord and organ music of the late American composer known as Moondog under the composer's supervision. Well, Gavin, when you read your bio, you can easily see your strong background in early keyboard music. And there's no question about that. You are an expert in so much of that. How did you get interested in Moondog, and how did you meet him for the first time?
Well, okay. Of course, as with everything else, it's a long story.
I had a feeling.
And I won't make it too short, because that's what we're here to talk about this stuff. But so I grew up in New Haven, and amongst the people I got to know there in the musical community was Paul Jordan, who at the time was organist at United Church on the Green in New Haven, and who became my organ teacher for a while and was a friend of mine, a very close friend and mentor of mine for the rest of his life. He died about a year ago. But Paul had grown up in New York and gotten to know Moondog. I think he just had success where you didn't in finding Moondog on the street. Sorry. But and by the time I got to know Paul, when Paul was in his late 20s and 10 years or so away from living in New York, he had known Moondog for a long time. He had played a lot of Moondog's music, owned copies of a lot of Moondog's music, and I'll mention parenthetically that that's always been a big issue. His music is not published in a very mainstream way and has always been sort of difficult to get hold of. But the gist of it is that one day at United Church on the Green, I think before I started taking organ lessons, but as I was getting interested in the organ and going there once in a while to play or have Paul play stuff for me, up on the music desk of the wonderful German Baroque style organ in that church was some Moondog. It was basically Xeroxes of handwritten stuff, and Paul was one of the few people who had that music. And this was maybe 1971, something like that. And I was just enchanted by the music. He played me little snippets of it. He played me a particular canon for organ that I have a record of here, played much later by me, and we're going to put that on. And I just loved the music. I mean, I think that it was partly the sounds of the music itself, which, of course, is sort of what we're here to explore, partly the fact that something about the way Paul talked about Moondog made him seem both really just sort of really cool and interesting and also really important. I was and am very lucky to have had Paul as a friend and mentor because he was interested in everything. I mean, he just embraced the world, and I don't know the beginnings of his contact with Moondog, but I know that he was a very good advocate for him and presented him as being really exciting. But it was through the music, which is sort of an interesting thing because, as you mentioned briefly, and I think I'll probably come back to later in discussing this, Moondog was for about 25 years extremely well known in and around New York. Once I got excited about Moondog, I discovered that everyone who'd ever been in New York to whom I said the word Moondog associated something with him. They knew what he looked like. They knew he was a sort of, in a sense, a kind of street person or a fixture on the streets of New York. Mm-hmm. And essentially no one knew that he wrote music. And that's a sort of interesting theme. But I first heard the music and kind of later found out that he, as part of what he did in his career, had created a somewhat eccentric persona and become well known for that. So that was how I discovered Moondog. Now, Paul Jordan was also sort of a specialist in older music. I mean, he was a wonderful and very erudite performer of that music. He also did more than I've ever done of the later stuff, but so he wasn't as much of a specialist in that sense. But he had discovered Moondog very personally, and he introduced me to that music.
Interesting. Now, Gavin, for the uninitiated, what was your initial impression of Moondog, and when did he refer to himself as Moondog, and how did he become blind?
Okay.
A little background.
Sure. I mean, so he was born in Maryville, Kansas, where his father was a preacher and also a lawyer and businessman. And the gist of the answer to your last question is that he was blinded in an accident involving some dynamite that he was playing around with when he was a teenager. So he was born with sight and so on, and had, of course, clear memories of sightedness. And I'm not remembering exactly how you framed the rest of the question.
No, well, that's okay.
So then he...
I mean, basically, how did his name come about? Moondog.
Sure, okay. Well, he moved to New York in 1943, and there are all sorts of complexities about that, of course. My impression is, and this isn't anything I know firsthand, but from what I've read and so on, that he was making a pretty clean break with his family and his upbringing and very, very consciously trying to sort of reinvent himself. And he came to New York to work as a musician, to try to sort of make his way as a composer and performer. And sometime between 1943 and 1947, he chose to start calling himself Moondog and to present his work under that name. And I'm going to come back to that later, that theme, because later in his life he had sort of other thoughts about that I can talk about. And he always said that he named himself after a dog he had who howled at the moon. I think I've heard versions in which that dog was also called Moondog, or versions in which the dog just inspired that name for himself.
Right.
And also sometime between 1943 and maybe the early 50s, he started wearing the very distinctive costume.
That's
that,
what I want,
like
you to
what you put
about
on the website or on the front of many of his records and so on, which he was quite tall and thinnish and sort of imposing looking, especially once he started wearing a very long beard and not particularly cutting his hair and so on. But to this he added a helmet, a very big leather helmet with big horns and various, at different times in his life, different mm-hmm. sorts of cloaks that were meant to be Viking, look like Viking stuff. And he carried a spear that was itself 6 feet tall. And what I've read, and again, I think this is one of those things where there might be different accounts or mythologies about this, but in an interview a while ago, he said, I mean, quite a while ago, unfortunately, he's been gone these 17 years, but he said that early in his days in New York, he was tall, kind of gaunt, with a black beard and long black hair. People commented that he resembled the sort of normal iconography of Jesus Christ. And he himself, it's interesting that his father was a preacher talking about this, was not very friendly towards Christianity and was at that point already getting much more interested in sort of Nordic mythology and various other mythologies. And I read that he said that he took on the Viking costume and sort of presented himself as a Viking so that people would quit saying that he looked like Christ. He wanted
That's
something
else. That's a
good
reason. Yeah,
good explanation.
Sure.
And I think it worked. So the Moondog name and the dress and the sort of demeanor and persona, again, late 40s, early 50s, I think in a broader sense, part of or maybe even a kind of exaggerated, to some people's taste, version of the basic phenomenon of trying to establish his own identity as distinct from his upbringing, in a sense.
Yeah.
And of course, I think it was in part his blindness that made him have to think very seriously about how to make his own way. I mean, he was, a lot of the time in his life, remarkably self-sufficient, lived by himself, got himself ready every morning, and invented and built instruments and all that stuff. So that's the gist of what I know about the sort of creation of the sort of the Moondog image and idea.
Well, let's go to some music.
Sure.
In fact, this is a very early recording from the early 1950s. This was originally recorded in the early 50s, as I said, but at the Spanish Music Center in New York City. This selection is played by Moondog with his wife at the time, Suzuka. We'll hear the Pastoral Suite. Did you want to say anything about this, or do you want to just jump it right in?
No, let's jump into it.
Okay,
Talk about it after.
It kind of speaks for itself. It consists of three very short movements, Before the Storm, and, well, you guessed it, After the Storm. Music by Moondog.
Thank you.
You were just listening to music by our man of the hour, Moondog. That was his pastoral suite, as performed by the composer along with his wife, Suzuko. And that was his wife at the time. I am here with Gavin Black, who knows Moondog's music very, very well, and actually knew the composer as well the last 22 years of his life, and we're going to be talking about some of his memories a little later on. Let's go back to, I guess you could say, Moondog's lifestyle when he was in New York, just for a little bit. There has been some kind of mix-up, you know, not mix-up, but different opinion. Was he homeless, actually, or not?
Well, as I understand it, the answer to that is no, that he was never homeless. Maybe I've heard or read here and there that he may have had a night when he spent the night out for some reason, but basically he always had somewhere to stay. Sometimes it was a place that he was renting himself. Occasionally he lived with people. He lived with Philip Glass for a year, apparently.
I read that about Glass. In fact, what I want to do later is talk about his influence on composers today.
Because which is very strong,
actually. It is huge.
Yes, yes.
It is huge. And so he was not homeless.
He was not homeless. Most of the time that he lived in New York, he had somewhere to stay in New York, which was often a very small place, I gather, physically small, which was easier for him to deal with logistically. But also during that time, he owned a cabin upstate where he would go for, you know, repose once in a while, really out in the country. So he was never homeless, and he was also not really a street musician in the sense of a sort of busker or whatever. He, as I understand it, and I didn't know him in these days, you know, I got to know him a bit later, but as I understand it, when he was standing on the street for, you know, 9, 10, 11 hours most days, he was talking to people, reciting poetry, maybe occasionally playing a bit of music, not primarily playing music. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is that he was spending that time composing music. And I think this wasn't necessarily known to people at the time, but one of the roles of that costume that he wore was to conceal his hands and the little Braille music writing machine that he had there.
That's interesting.
Under his cloak.
I've never heard that.
Typing away on this Braille machine, which I think I've heard was his own design, certainly his own notation, which is also something we'll probably come back to later because it ties in with things about the dissemination of his music and publication or non-publication.
So he actually, did he sell his music to people, or how did he make his
Yeah, my impression, well, my impression is that he sold more poetry than music to people as they as they encountered him in the street, some music. There was always this issue about the Braille notation and getting the music transcribed, so I think it was easier for him to sell poetry. Right. As far as how he made his living is concerned, I think there are mostly rumors about that. There are people who know more about that than I do, which is a tie-in with, we're going to mention the very fine biography of Moondog that is out there a little bit later. But I've read that he made belts for a while, made and sold belts.
Yeah. Belts, like belts?
Yeah, like we have on our trousers. I've read, I mean, again, I don't know. And by the time I read that, it was way too late for me to check that out with him, unfortunately. Yeah. But so I think miscellaneous things, and he lived frugally. I think that's the gist of it.
That's it. Well, let's go to some more music.
Sure.
We're going to listen to Bird's Lament, written in honor of Charlie Parker, a wonderful piece, and that will be followed by Witch of Endor, which was actually part of a ballet Moondog wrote for Martha Graham. And we hear a group of freelance musicians from New York, and this is from the 1969 Columbia album titled Moondog.